so quick. My name is Cindy. I'm an addict.
Hey, Cindy.
I am from the Bay Area of Maryland, which is like Glen Burnie and Annapolis and around in there. And my home group is Shelter from the Storm, Monday nights, 7 o'clock. So if you're ever down that way, come see us. There's a couple of home group members in the room. I'm kind of nervous. This is the first workshop that I've ever done at a convention. And it's kind of special for me because I was thinking about the topic, Moral Be Revealed. And I was thinking, you know, life is really about moral be revealed. And it wasn't until I got into recovery that I actually realized that. Because before I got into recovery and got clean, life was about why me? Why does this keep happening to me? Why do I keep doing this stupid stuff? When is it ever going to get better? And it was probably about, and I'm probably going to cry, I'm going to warn you right now, I'm a crier. Every Sunday night, Extreme Makeover and The Big Give, I'm like bawling in front of the TV. So, so it was probably, it was about 10 years ago that I lived here. I lived in Ocean City. It was one of my geographical cures. I had been living in D.C. Things got, like, ridiculous. And, of course, as some of us do, you know, the easiest thing to do is to just pick up and leave and go someplace else. And, you know, at the time, I didn't know that wherever I went, I took me with me. So I came here, and, of course, you know, it was like a day, probably, before I was right back doing the same stuff I was doing in D.C. And it was here in Ocean City that I probably used the hardest and really, really just gave up any kind of hope that I had. And it was here almost 10 years ago that I stood on the Route 50 bridge looking over the water at night into, like, the depths and the blackness of the water swirling around and the rocks down in the inlet, and I just wanted to freaking jump in. I just wanted to jump in. I wanted the pain to be over. And I wanted it to end, but of course I didn't have enough guts to jump over because there's always that thought, oh, well, then I'll end up paralyzed and then life will really suck. And I couldn't do it. And now here, almost 10 years later, my first convention was in Ocean City. It was the first Ocean Gateway Convention in 98. And my first CMP was 99. And it's just pretty cool to me that as more was revealed, I hit my bottom here, and I'm doing my first convention workshop here. So it's really cool, and it's an honor, and I want to thank the God of my understanding and the CMP region for having me out. I went to the beach this morning, not for the sunrise meeting, because I didn't get up that early, but I went down to the beach to get centered, because the ocean for me has always been an attraction and a place for me to get centered. And I went down, and, you know, it was kind of cloudy and stuff. And ever since I was a little girl, because I was born in Massachusetts, and going to the beach was just something I did every day, all summer long. And being the self-centered, good little addict that I probably was at the age of 3, it was all about me, and it was my ocean, because my mother told me that I used to be, when they used to drag me away from the beach to go home, I used to stand there on the beach and go, my osh, my osh, like I didn't want to leave. So it was all about me and my ocean. And even when I was down here and using, I would go to the beach for a source of comfort. So I went to the beach this morning, and, you know, I started thinking about all the things that have been revealed throughout my life and throughout recovery. And, you know, I don't think any one of us in this room probably ever thought that we would be sitting here in an NA chair in an NA convention, or any one of us that would have thought that the things that we did to ourselves were done to us would have ever happened. But luckily, we did all find ourselves here, and now we get a chance to live a new way of life. And I went through and I read the basic text chapter, and, you know, I brought my basic text with me because it makes me feel better. And, you know, that's one of my favorite chapters, is Moral Be Revealed. And if you haven't read it yet, or you haven't read it in a while, go back and read it, because it pretty much covers everything. It's like the hope chapter. It tells you you never have to use no matter what. It tells you what to do if you have to take medication. It tells you that pain is a gift. It tells you pretty much everything you have to do to stay clean and recover. Recovery to me has revealed a lot. because I certainly didn't think that I would ever wind up in Ocean City, Maryland, standing on a bridge wanting to jump off. Because I came from a pretty normal, I don't know, middle-class family. My dad died when I was 7, and at that time I copped probably my first big major resentment at God, except I didn't know it was a resentment because I was 7. Because I had been going to Sunday school, and, you know, people came back from the dead in the Bible, so I thought that maybe God was going to bring my father back, and he never did. And there was that anger and that just that anger and that I don't know what to do with it, so I turned it inward, and I just became very resentful. I acted out a lot when I was little, and then I always felt there was that feeling that I didn't fit in. So I just started turning to other stuff to try and fit in. And at first, it was like fantasy. Because all through elementary school and all through high school, I read a lot, I watched TV, I had a single parent, I was an only child, I wanted to be part of the Brady Bunch, so like I wanted to be Marsha. Marsha. You know, I wanted to be part of the Brady Bunch, or I wanted to be like the Cleaver's long-lost daughter or something. So the fantasy worked for a little while. And then, you know, as I went to high school and stuff, I thought, you know, you get into like the cliques and you want to be accepted. So I became like the chameleon, so I used like people-pleasing and changing who I was and changing how I acted to try and fill that hole. And I went off to college, like, pre-med, okay? At that point, I really hadn't, like, I'd tried drinking a little bit, and I had tried some things, but I was a good girl when I went away to college. And as more would be revealed, once I hit college and my mother wasn't there to overprotect me anymore, the game was on, because I picked up some of those things and found out that I could feel cute with the boys, and I could stay up and study all night, and I could feel comfortable, and it was a lot of fun. And I thought it was a lot of fun, because everybody else was doing it, right? And I really didn't, I really didn't have a drug of choice, because it was more. I've always struggled with the word enough. I have never known the meaning of the word enough. It doesn't matter what it is. Shoes, drugs, food, boys, classes, it doesn't matter. So I thought it was fun, and I progressed in my 20s, and of course, you know, you can't party 7 nights a week and not be on academic probation. Some people could, I couldn't. So as more was revealed, I left school to take a year off and never went back, because then started, the disease had me in the grip. And it wasn't fun anymore. I thought it was fun because I was in, you know, that thing we call denial. And I thought it was fun. And I thought it was a good time. And it seemed like a good idea. And I was one of those people, like it says in the chapter, I was one of those people that using is the way of life. And you people that get up and go to work at 8 and 9 o'clock in the morning, you have no idea what life is all about. And I remember being in D.C. coming home from like an after-hours club on 13th and U, maybe, or 9th and U, something like that. It was Asylum back then. And if anybody knows where it is, I've spent many hours there. You know, rolling home from the after-hours club at 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, watching everybody going to work, laughing at you because, well, hey, I was broke going home. Like, couldn't pay my rent, but I was living the life. So at that point, my whole lifestyle started to be very disposable. I disposed of relationships. I disposed of cars and jobs and belongings and apartments. And I still thought it was manageable. And I did all the geographic cures, and I thought everything was fine, and I'm going to be fine. And I got a DWI back when I first moved to Virginia in, like, 89. I got two weeks apart. But I didn't think there was a problem, and they made me go to AA, and I made some half-hearted attempt to stay sober or whatever, but I was in my 20s, and I'm like, it's too soon for this. So as I progressed down the road, I didn't know that I was slipping into the depths, and my life was going from being pre-med and having dreams to living the D words that they talk about in the basic text. Because at the end, my life was all about the D words: disease, despair, degradation, wanting to die, depression, dereliction. Because as more was revealed in my addiction, it just got worse. It didn't get better. No matter what I did, it never got better. I tried everything. I tried going back to church. I tried everything. And the real bottom was one of the things that I always wanted, because in my family, you go to college, you get a degree, you get married, you have kids, and you live happily ever after. That's what everybody in my family does, except for me, because I'm the black sheep of the family. So I thought, you know, I always wanted to get married. I always wanted to have kids. I always, as much as I despise that about my family, not because it was a bad thing, it was just because I didn't have it and I wanted what they had and I didn't know how to get it. I had always wanted a family. So when I was living here and I turned up pregnant, I thought that that baby was going to save me and it was going to be the answer. It was God's answer to make me change my life. Except at that point, the disease of addiction had me so caught in the grip that I could not stop using, no matter what. I could not stop. I altered it a little bit, but I couldn't stop. And as more was revealed, I went for my first prenatal checkup, and they couldn't find a heartbeat, and I lost the baby. So at that point, that was one of those things where it talks about in the basic text that, like, pain and loss can be a gift. Except I didn't know that at the time. At the time, it was about, why me? When is this ever going to end? And it was at that point, I honestly believe today, that God gave me that gift so that I would go in such a downward spiral that I would hit a bottom. Because it wasn't long after that that I woke up one day and I called my mom and I told her that I was done and I needed to get the heck out of here. She had me on a plane. I went home. It was like May 20th, 1998. I walked into an outpatient. And by the grace of God, I've been clean ever since. I was so beat down and so broken, I never found it necessary to go out and like do any more research. But I didn't go home to recover. I went to go, like, I wanted them to lock me up for 28 days. I wanted to get better. I wanted to rest. And I wanted to go on about my business. But as more was revealed, it wasn't about just being clean. It was about a recovery process and a program and a journey that was going to take me on a path to some things that are totally beyond my wildest dreams. Because I just wanted to, you know, rest and learn how to use successfully, and I was going to come back to Ocean City and be able to, like, go out to whatever, Fager's, and have a beer, and all was going to be well. But I walked into an NA meeting, and because I started out, I went to AA for, like, a couple weeks or so, and I walked into my first NA meeting, and something happened. I finally felt at home, and I finally felt like I was in the right place. And I finally felt hope that the hole was going to get filled and that I was in a place where I would be accepted. And I stayed. And I did the things that people told me to do. I got a sponsor. I started working steps. I got in service. You know, and a lot has happened on that path. A lot has happened on that path. And, you know, more gets revealed. When I remember in rehab writing down, you had to write down, even doing step work, I think, I had to write down, like, my reservations and what my reservations were, and I pretty much narrowed it down to two. What would happen if my mom died? Would I be able to stay clean? And if somebody walked up to me with, like, a bazillion dollars or an obscene amount of money and said, here's $1 million, all you got to do is take a hit, could I say no? And my relationship with my mother when I got clean, I'm surprised she even, like, put me on a plane, because, you know, it had been one of those, like, she had been going to Al-Anon for probably 10 years, and she had a black belt, and so when I called and asked for money, she was like, no, I don't think so, and I'd say, well, F you, and I don't need you, and I'd slam the phone down. And when I got home, she had an alarm system, and I didn't get a key to the house for 6 months, and that alarm was set every night, so it was just like being in a halfway house or being locked up, because if I tried to go out that door, the alarm would go off, and the whole neighborhood would wake up. And she had called the cops on me before when I was using, because I'd come back to get my stuff, and she was afraid of me or whoever whatever derelict I was bringing with me. And, you know, so I put my mother through a lot. And when I got clean in Rochester, New York, because that's where I'm from. And there's Trudy sitting right there. She had probably the most clean time of any woman in the Rochester area, except she didn't talk to me for like a year and a half. And I always thought that, you know, she didn't like me, or because you know how we are. Like, everybody, like, you can have, like, 20 people that, like, give you hugs and love you, but that one person that just won't even look at you, you're like, well, why don't they like me? It's all about we just focus on that, like, negativity. Anyway, so as time progressed, I lived with my mom for a little while, and what was revealed was, instead of my mother being this overprotective shrew that wanted to, like, mess my life up, she really became one of my best friends. Because as I started to get into service and get a sponsor and do steps, she got a sponsor in Al-Anon. She started working steps. She had sponsees. She was like on the Al-Anon convention committee or something like that. I mean, she like did everything I did. And we developed a really, really good relationship. I moved down to Baltimore, I think with like 3 years clean. And it was a couple of years after I moved down, she called me one day and she's like, I have to fax you some papers. And I said, for what? She goes, well, I want you to be my power of attorney. This is a woman who wouldn't let me in her house, and she trusted me enough to give me power of attorney. And the rest of my family, they're either a teacher or they're a minister. So for me to be what I turned out to be is very, like, they didn't know how to deal with me. And how that's gone out and how that's played out, my relationships with my family have been restored as well. In fact, my aunt, who I thought would just be the most judgmental person on me on the face of the earth, said to me, Cindy, there was never any doubt in my mind that you would stay clean and you would be successful at this, because I know that when you make up your mind to do something, you do it. And that blew me away, because this is a woman that, like, wouldn't let me into her house. So my relationship with my mom got better, and I was home in 2003. My mother wanted me to come home. It was a couple days before my birthday, so I flew home, and I'm home, and we're going over, and I was doing, like, four-step stuff, and I was asking my mom all kinds of questions, which usually she had, like, because you don't talk about stuff in my family. You just don't talk about it. You know what I mean? It's like, everything's fine. It's like if you walk into somebody's house and it's really neat, but then you open the closets and all this crap falls out, that's what our family was like. So she, like, changed the subject on a lot of painful stuff, and I had a lot of, like, questions, and she never really talked about them until that weekend. She decided to start answering some of these questions. So we had a really good talk, and we went through all these pictures, and it was really cool, and I got up to go to fly back to Baltimore on Sunday, and I went into my mom's room, and I couldn't wake her up. And to make a long story short, later that night, she was gone. And because of the program and because God has revealed some really, really good friends to me, Trudy, the woman that wouldn't talk to me, drove 45 minutes to the hospital to be with me. And the only person that was able to give me any comfort at that time was her, because my family was being all the way they were being. My cousin was out in the hall screaming and crying, and my cousin's out in the hallway making excuses. Well, you know, she lost her father when she was 7, and that's why she's taking it hard. And I'm like, why don't you just shut the F up and let me be where I am? And I didn't use, because the first thing I wanted to do was go to a meeting. So as Warren was revealed, that reservation was blown out of the water. And I feel pretty confident today that if somebody walked up to me with even $5 million, I would probably say, you know what, keep your whatever it is, because I don't want any, I don't need it. So that was like, you know, just like it says in the chapter, there's a painful experiences are gifts. Every painful relationship I've been through, when I'm in it, this sucks, why me, blah, 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 and when I'm through it and I'm able to get through it, it boosts my spirit, it boosts my character, it makes me believe and have the faith that no matter what happens, I can get through the next thing that happens. And I've had a couple of doozies of relationships because one of the things, you know, you get clean and you're still the same person. And my choice of the opposite sex really didn't change from when I was using. And it took me probably 3 times of being curled up on a fetal position on my kitchen floor to realize that I had to really change that pattern. And I never thought that I could do what I've been doing, but I've been like not in a relationship and pretty much celibate for like 3 or 4 years. And it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. Because as I was talking with some of my friends, like, and I never would have thought that because that was like a huge part of like who I was. Like, that's like what you do. You know, I found validation through like, and I'm sorry, but I found validation through picking up men, looking cute. If I can get you in bed, then hey, I still got it. Look at me. And looking for that fulfillment in the wrong places. And because of, you know, working on myself and learning some stuff, you know, that's not going to do it anymore. And you know what? You don't get testers here, okay? You just don't get testers anymore. You know, you got to, like, commit. So, you know, and that's been a huge change for me. Things that I never, ever, ever, ever thought that I would get to do have happened. I've gotten to go to Hawaii. You know, when I went to the World Convention, I was like, Hawaii is like one of those places like you read about in a magazine and like, oh yeah, yeah, like I'm gonna get there. And I got there. And I like was like the best day of my life probably was driving in this beat up Suzuki we rented, driving up to the North Shore. I had like a sarong and a bathing suit on. The wind was whipping through my hair and I'm like, how does life get any better than this? Clean. You know, swimming with the dolphins. I mean, I used to be like in a one-room apartment in West Ocean City, and my world was limited to like a square mile. The bar, my guy delivered, so I didn't have to go get it usually. And that's it. I worked and I used, and I worked and I used, and that's it. And now my life is so completely full, it's probably too full. I've had so many good and like real friends, like because the kind of friends that I had before, you know, they're there when you have something or they're there when it's convenient. And I disposed of a lot of friendships, so I'm like not pointing any fingers because I was one of those people. But I have like lasting friendships. When my mom died in Rochester, there was probably like 20. I hadn't been in the area for like 3 years, and there was probably 20 or 30 people that showed up and went to her funeral. I got friends now that like pack up my entire freaking house and move me because that's what we do in here. I've been able to show up and be a friend. A couple, it was like last year, a friend of mine had a mass on her brain and I was able to show up for her every single day in the hospital. Another friend of mine had breast cancer. You know, I was able to show up for her. I've been able to like move through a lot of painful experiences with a little bit of grace and dignity now. In the beginning, it wasn't like that. You know, it was kicking and screaming and clawing and whatever. But as we grow in the program and as I've grown in the program and done step work and worked on myself, I'm able to do stuff with a little bit more grace and dignity. And it's a little bit easier to let go now. Another thing that has been revealed to me is, you know, back then, I had a resentment against church and that God of my understanding because it was the God that I was made, I don't know, to go see every Sunday. And I had a problem with that. I didn't have a problem with, like, a higher power, but I had a problem with, like, who that higher power was going to be, what it was going to be. So I did the whole, like, I looked into the crystals, and I read up on Buddha, and, you know, because you guys said, hey, you can pick whoever you want. I was like, yes! So I thought I'd piss my family off a little bit more and go find somebody else. And it was funny because they gave me, I think it was like my second year anniversary, they gave me a book called Bad Girls of the Bible. And I just laughed because I was like, they're trying. They're really trying. But, you know, as I slowly, like, came, like, full circle back to the faith of my childhood, except now it's not about going and sitting and standing and kneeling and whatever else. It's more of a spiritual thing. It's kind of in a religious context, but it's a spiritual, it's a relationship like it talks about in our steps. And to have a higher power and to have a God back in my life has been the best thing that's happened. Because without God, I don't even think I'd be here. I probably would be at the bottom of the inlet. I think because it was God that put that spark in me the day that I got up and I looked in the mirror, and I remember it like it was yesterday. I looked in the mirror and I did not know who the hell I was looking at. I could barely look in the mirror. My eyes were dead. I'm like, how the heck did I get here? How did I get here? And now I can look in the mirror and I can be happy with who I see, happy with who I am today, and happy with who I'm becoming. Because all this stuff has been revealed to me in the past almost 10 years has created the faith in me to know that more is going to get revealed and it's just going to get even better. Because I came in here broken, and I'm not completely mended yet, but I'm certainly on the course, and I'm on the right path to heal a lot of stuff. Just a lot of really, really cool stuff has happened in recovery. Another, like, kind of cool story is I have a dog named Star, and I got her after my mom died, and this was, like, another, like, little more will be revealed kind of thing. I've had a problem with, like, sometimes I can't even take care of myself, and so everybody was like, oh, yeah, you should go get a dog or a cat or whatever, and I'm like, I can't take care of a dog, please. The poor thing will be, like, dead. It'll be starving for water. I can't take care of that. I'm too busy. And I went, one of my friends dragged me down to the ASPCA, and there was this cute little puppy, and her name was Star the Puppy, and she had one ear up and one ear flopped down. And I'm like, I fell in love with her, and I'm like, okay, fine. So I put in the application, I get the dog, I bring the dog home, I'm like, because I don't know if you guys can identify this, but I'm really more okay with failure than I am with, like, success and responsibility. And that dog scared the crap out of me, because I'm like, this is another life that I have to take care of, because I don't have any kids. You know, I've probably killed every plant that I've ever had. And my mom was funny one year because she gave me a plant for my anniversary, and she said, so when that, remember that movie, like, 28 Days? She was like, yeah, if the plant lives, then you can get in another relationship. I'm like, Mom. So I bring the dog home, and I'm, like, freaking out. I'm like, oh, I should bring this dog back, and I don't know, and I don't know if I can, like, train it right, and just all that self-doubt, and it's really not about the dog. It's about the interference of self-doubt, and I can't do this. And God sent a message because, like, probably 4 or 5 days after I got her, and I'm still going through the doubt thing, I get all of her papers in the mail from the SPCA, the rabies shots, all that. She was born July 28th, 2003, which happens to be the same day that my mother died.
Oh, my.
So I still had the dog. And she is, you know, and she is, like, the little apple of my eye. And there's lots of cool stories like that. You know, like, I'm one of those people that I see symbols in everything. I remember being 90 days clean and driving down the expressway in Rochester, and I was, like, leaving outpatient and on my way to work, and there's construction because, being self-centered, construction and traffic always happens to me. You know, why are you in my way? So I'm driving down the road, and I'm freaking out, and, you know how, I don't know, I remember how I was in 90 days. I was all, like, chaotic, and everything was, like, pissed me off, and da 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 da. And I'm driving down the road just like that, and I'm like, you know, God, where are you? Da 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 da. And this truck pulls up next to me with DOD on it. I was like, well, okay. Of course it means general overnight delivery, but I didn't know that. And to me it was a God truck, and God was like, okay, I'm right here, and I'm going to lead the way because it passed me. But it's just like little cool things like that that have made recovery the joy that it is. Service work has given me the opportunity to like really be responsible. Actually, it gave me the principle of commitment because I didn't know anything about that. I've been able to become a leader. I've learned a lot. If you need some work practicing acceptance and tolerance, I suggest that you get a service commitment at the region or the area. You laugh, but it's true, because I was always one to judge, and you're doing this and you're doing that wrong. Try running a region or an area without posturing or saying what you want to say. Try holding in your opinion, and that'll give you a crash course in acceptance and tolerance and self-restraint and respect. Because I remember when I first got into service, like I went to the Rochester area service and the chair was coming across the table at a GSR, and I'm like, what is this? And I go into Marlikna and there's people with like a bazillion years clean up there like rambling on about something. But it's all the love of NA. It's all for the love of NA. And that really helped me grow a lot. And it also helped me in other areas of my life, because everything I learn in here, I try to apply out there. You know, I've been able to become a really good employee. As a matter of fact, I'm in a spot right now where I've kind of been thrust. I started a job doing a job that I've never done before. And now a year later, the guy who was kind of over me got promoted. They haven't replaced him, so I'm doing both our jobs. And I'm salary, so that translates into, yes, you have to work 12 hours a day, and no, we're not gonna pay you overtime. And the old me probably really would have bitched about that a lot more, and well, you need to give me this, and blah, 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 blah. But you know what? I'm stepping up to the plate, and I'm doing it. But I gotta tell you, I'm scared crapless. Because it's that same, I'm gonna fail. And I'd probably be okay with that, but the bigger fear is what happens if I succeed and they like promote me. Can I do it? And I'm like, you know, and I'm like, there's sometimes you gotta fake it till you make it, and I'm faking it right now till I make it, because I'm scared to death. Achieving past whatever I've gone to at a certain point doesn't feel good to me, because it's out of my comfort zone. I'm used to being like in Ocean City, we used to say that this was the underachiever capital of the world, because a lot of the people I was working with in the restaurant business, they had like master's degrees and they were going to go to law school and whatever, and here we are bartending, waiting tables, you know, and drinking our brains out every night. And it was okay. But so I'm like used to that whole like, oh, I'm just going to get to a certain point and I'm going to skate by, and it's not okay anymore. Because I don't want to live like that anymore, because as more has been revealed, just skating by and just doing enough isn't enough. It's not enough. But because of everything that's happened so far, I think that I have the faith in myself, I certainly have the faith in God, to know that I can get to the next level and that everything coming down the pike is going to be better than it already has been. And I don't know what God has in store for me. I don't know what's going to be revealed. I have no idea. I have an idea of something that's getting ready to be revealed, because God's funny. I was in a Salvation Army or something like that. I have a problem with, like, intimacy, and I don't mean, like, the sexual intimacy, but I want to, because I get to a certain point and then I kind of cut myself off, I do that with a lot of relationships and a lot of friendships. I get to a certain point where I expose just enough, and then I'm like, you know what? I don't want you to know the whole me. And I hang back, and I kind of like to be on the outside. And part of me wants to be, like, in a deeper intimacy with other people, but then part of me doesn't. And I know that's one thing that I need, and I know it's one thing that I need to work on. I have a lot of good friendships, but they could be better. My best friend just moved to Florida, and being an ocean person, I'll probably be down there in a couple years, but more will be revealed. But I know that I can do better. I know that I can step up my level of intimacy, my willingness to be more open and more involved in some of my relationships. And, you know, and I'm starting to think about that other relationship, the relationship with, like, the opposite sex. And so I'm trolling the books in the Salvation Army because I'm always looking for the first edition basic text and, you know, whatever else is there, hoping one day that I'm going to find one of those, maybe. And I see this book, and the title of the book was No More Lonely Nights, and I'm like, oh, cool, this is probably like some trashy, like sex-filled romance novel, and I'll just take it home, it'll be easy to read, whatever. It wasn't a novel. It was a book written by these two psychologists about women who avoid intimate relationships with men and have not been in a committed relationship or haven't gotten married. And I'm like, huh, this is real funny. And after I read the first three chapters, I was like, man, I am screwed. So I have a feeling, again, nothing happened in my life by coincidence. So I'm having a feeling that I'm probably going to need to start working in that area. I've made a decision to go back into therapy, do some step work on it, and we'll see what happens. But more will be revealed. And I'm going to, I have 5 minutes left, so I'm going to tell you my little signature analogy story. I've heard a lot of people have analogy stories. There's this one woman that tells this really cool story about a teacup. Mine is about beach glass. There was a couple years ago, we were out on the beach in Ocean City, and it's really hard to find beach glass in Ocean City now just because of the sands and people pick stuff up and whatever. So we're walking on the beach, and I actually found a piece of beach glass. And remember I told you that I see stuff in, because I can do that now, you know. I can look, like today, the clouds were in the sky and the sun wasn't out, and as I was getting ready to walk back up to the hotel, the sun broke through and there's like that little ray, and of course, me being self-centered, it looked like that little ray of sunshine was coming right to me. And it was like a little bit like, okay, you're totally not gonna bomb, and you know, it's gonna be cool and you're gonna be okay. So the piece of beach glass, I started looking at it and I started thinking about it. The piece of glass came from a bottle. The bottle at once was whole, as we start out our lives, because this is like a recovery analogy. And somewhere along the line, whether we do it to ourselves or someone does it to us, we get broken. Into like a bazillion different pieces, we get broken. Some people never make it into recovery or into a process of change and healing. Because those people, those pieces, get thrown into the dumpster, the incinerator, the trash, whatever. They get burned up, they never have a chance. Some of the pieces of glass get thrown into the ocean or somehow make their way into the ocean. And the ocean has tides and there's storms. And with every high tide or every, you know, when the tide is high, the glass is like on the bottom of the ocean. If there's a storm, it's tumbling around. And then at low tide, it kind of spits itself back out on the beach. Hopefully it's sunny, the light hits it, it glints, it looks pretty. While the piece of glass is at the bottom of the ocean, tumbling around, it's getting smoother, and the sharp edges that used to hurt other people and hurt ourselves are becoming smoother because it's in the process. So when it's underwater and it's stormy and it's rolling around on the bottom, it's getting shaped and it's getting smoothed out. And then in low tide, it kind of spits you back out and there's sun and, you know, everything's like lovely and you get a chance to like breathe and shine. And then someday, perhaps at low tide, there's a piece of beach glass and someone might pick you up and turn you into something more useful. And I don't have my props, as somebody called it, but I have like a necklace that's a piece of beach glass. I have like a little wind chime thing that's all beach glass, because you can turn something broken. I mean, they sell things of beach glass in the craft stores. Okay, so you take something broken, it goes through the process of storms and sunshine and storms and sunshine, the edges get smoothed out and it turns into something useful that can be beautiful, used in art and admired by everybody. So that's my analogy of recovery. So if you're a piece of beach glass right now, whether you got 2 months, 2 years, 20 years, and your edges are feeling a little rough, just stay in the process. Don't be afraid to be underwater. Don't be afraid of the storms, because more is always going to be revealed if you just stay in the process and keep coming back, and I certainly will. Thank you for listening, and
thank you so much, Cindy. Next, I give you Jude C. from Gaithersburg, Maryland.
Good morning. I'm an addict named Judith.
Hey, Judith.
And I just want to thank God for being here. I want to thank God for the gift of life and the gift of recovery. I want to thank you, Cindy. Powerful, powerful analogy. And I just really like how you, you know, revealed to us the topic. More will be revealed. And I just want to say that normally when I come to conventions, I'm usually the first speaker. But this morning, you know, when Cindy asked, you know, well, you know, who should go first? And we were trying to figure it out. I was like, you go first. Like Cindy, I didn't spend a lot of time with the topic. And it wasn't really neglect. It was that I trusted that the God of my understanding knew something that I didn't know. I knew that the God of my understanding knew exactly who was going to be in this seat at the time that I was going to share, and he knew exactly what parts of my experience, strength, and hope that you guys would need to hear. So although I did spend some time, as she said, she spent some time on the beach this morning, I did spend a little bit of time this morning getting centered, as well as I turned in and had an early night last night to just be clear, to just make sure that I was a yielded vessel so that I could be used and be of maximum service today. So I just want to thank the CPRC and A22 for asking me to come and share on the topic. More will be revealed. You know, and I had a sponsor, a really, really good sponsor, my first sponsor. And as we began getting to know each other, and as she began looking at me and my character, one thing that she taught me to do, she taught me that as we're going through the step work, as we're being asked to speak on topics, either in our home group or at conventions, she said, get in the habit of looking words up. She said, as a matter of fact, if it's not the word A, the, or that, I got you looking it up. Because you really don't know all that you think you know. She said, and I want you to get a deeper concept of what we're dealing with here, this monster called addiction. And so she taught me from the very on to begin looking up words. So although I've read the chapter in the basic text, more will be revealed many times. As I began, you know, laying before this topic in preparation for today's message, I looked up the word revealed. And what the word revealed meant, it meant exposure through experience. It meant being brought to light. So you're looking at a girl who, for most of my life, I hid out in darkness most of my life. But after being in recovery, after being blessed with the gift of recovery, the darkness and the denial began to fall off, and I began getting to being brought into light places. And so more was revealed to me because I was no longer as much in the dark as I was when I came in. Just to qualify myself, like most of us in this room, I used drugs and used drugs and used drugs. But at the end of the road, drugs used me. I'm talking about being caught up in a vicious cycle. No way out. Caught up in a vicious cycle. Couldn't get out. The more I used, the more I hurt. The more I hurt, the more I used. I remember being an experimenter one day, going in a crack house in Camden, New Jersey. And by the time I left that house, I had gone from being an experimenter to an addict. And the line was so thin, it was invisible. I didn't know what had come over me. I had no concept of the word powerless because I graduated from college summa cum laude, and I was one of my mother's smartest kids. So I thought I was too smart to get hooked on drugs. I remember having a boyfriend because I conveniently picked my boyfriends. And I remember having a boyfriend who was a big drug dealer. And I remember him coming in one day and catching me, you know, cooking up some of the cocaine that he had given me. And he saw, he was just observing the way I was hitting that pipe, and he tried to slap that pipe out of my hand. And I snatched it back, and I said, I'm not going to get hooked. I'm above the people that get hooked. And I remember he said, you think you know everything. That went in one ear and out the other, because I did think that I knew everything. It wasn't until later on that I realized that I really didn't know anything at all. So I remember now being caught up in the bondage of addiction, which again mystified me because I had safely smoked weed for 10 years prior. Had no idea that I had become a weed addict because my life was still intact. I was still able to work. I made a lot of money off of selling the weed. So some of the things that showed me that I was an addict once I began dealing with the crack, it wasn't showing there because I always had enough. I was never at a deficit or a loss. And I would say that, you know, I'm not an addict. I just like to have a joint every day. So I wasn't in touch with the fact that I was a weed addict. But once crack cocaine came into my life, my career as a weed dealer ended quickly. Because the progression of my disease was that I would, on payday, I would buy the pounds of weed, and then with the excess money, that was what I would use to buy my cocaine. But after 2 hours after that, then I would run out of money. And then as a result of running out of money, instead I was too crippled to be able to sell the weed as I had done before, so I began pawning it off in exchange for rocks. And then there came the day that I didn't even make the trip to go get the weed. And things got worse and worse and worse. I found myself becoming broke the same night of payday. And now what happens once you run out of money? What happens next? Now it's time to steal. Now it's time to go to any lengths to hurt whoever, to be able to lay down with whoever, for whatever, whenever. Whatever it takes to get that last one. That was the state I found myself in. No regard for consequences. Knowing that you could get locked up stealing somebody's credit card. Knowing that you can get fired or locked up stealing money orders from Western Union. But caught up in the grip. A hit was the most important thing in my life. I had a daughter at the time who was 5 years old. And I would leave her on my mother. But when it came time to spending time with my daughter or buying my daughter some shoes or spending some money on my daughter, buying her food versus getting a hit, the hit won out every time. Every time. When it came to girlfriends who trusted me with their life and with their car, taking their car, telling them I'm going to be back, and then missing in action for days with their car. It used to hurt me so bad that they still kept trusting me time and time again, and I would keep letting them down. A constant state of degradation. My life continued to spiral downwards. I remember my geographic cure was moving here to Maryland because I am from Philadelphia and the New Jersey area. So there was a point in my life when my life got so low that I said, if I could just get away from this situation, then I can stop using. And so I came here on a trailways from Philadelphia to Maryland. And people would always ask me, what brought you to Maryland? And I would say, trailways. And they would say, no, really, what brought you to Maryland? Trailways. Using that as a geographic cure. But how many of you know that it was only a New York minute before I began able to find the people, places, and things in the Maryland, D.C. area that could get me high? Only took a minute, because the thing that needed to happen on the inside hadn't happened. That deep level of surrender that's required for this addict to get and stay clean hadn't taken place yet. And I was sick and tired of being sick and tired and being sick and tired of me. One of the things that hurt me the most was the separation that it caused my daughter. You know, she already didn't know who her father was. And now here she's a motherless and a fatherless child. And it hurt so bad. But I was caught up in the grip to do anything about it. I remember leaving her in New Jersey and moving here, trying to get and stay clean. And I remember, though, that there were times like holidays, like Thanksgiving and Christmas, when I was expected to show up, and I couldn't show up. Because, you see, my daughter wanted a basketball 1 year. And in good faith, I put the basketball and a lot of toys on layaway at Kmart. But at the end of the night, and I ran out of money, what did I do? I went back to Kmart, and I took that stuff off of layaway, promising myself that I would make it back to Kmart the next week, never being able to make it out. So now here comes Christmas, and here comes a little girl in New Jersey looking to see her mother and looking to see the basketball, and I had freebased up the basketball. And I was too ashamed to pick up the phone of mother's house and say, I'm an addict and I can't make it. There's too many hen houses in between here and the train station to make it to Jersey. Too ashamed. I would attempt to pick up the phone and call, and I would do so. But I had someone on the other end picked up the phone, and I could listen to the festivities in the background. I would hang up because I was too ashamed, too caught up in the grip. And I had a family that didn't understand the nature of addiction because I had a father who was an alcoholic, but my family, we didn't understand that there was a disease called alcoholism. It was just mentioned that he drank a lot and that if he wanted to stop in and of himself, he could. So later on, when I got hooked on drugs, that same thought pattern permeated in my life. And they were like, oh, she's just getting high because she wants to. She can stop if she wants to. They didn't realize that I wanted to stop but couldn't. They didn't realize that there was something inside of me that was bigger than me, that without the help of other people would doom me to a life of always using. And so my family was not able to be there for me as a unit of strength and a unit of support. So although I thought that I, the primary reason that I moved from Philadelphia, New Jersey area to Maryland was to be able to get away from the drugs, what got revealed later on was that support net that I was looking for in Jersey, I would have never gotten. But by me coming to Maryland, that was actually opening the door and allowing God to put some people in my life who could give me the help and support that I needed. Speaking about more will be revealed. And as I said, this topic, more will be revealed, being brought to light, denial and darkness was where I hid out most of my life. And you know the thing about recovery? There are things also revealed doesn't mean that something just got there. The whole word revealed means that it was something that was already there. We just couldn't see it because there was a lot of dirt and there was a lot of junk on the outside. Remember that song? I can see clearly now that the rain is gone. I can see all obstacles in my way. Gone are the dark clouds that had me blind. It's going to be a bright, bright, sunshiny day. That song came to me. And as I go forward, as I continue to grow in recovery, I'm being able to see things in my life that I couldn't see before. Because as I work the steps with a sponsor, it's like, as we always say, it's like the peeling, the onion, just layer by layer by layer, more is being revealed. My perspective is changing. I want to share about the different revelations that I've had since I've been here. And one of the first things that got revealed to me once I made the decision that I was going to surrender, which was necessary in order to get and stay clean, was that it got revealed to me that I didn't have to use even when I wanted to. Now that just blew me away, because before coming into recovery and surrendering on the level that I had surrendered, it was like I might start out going to meetings and pick up my chip for the X amount of days or months clean. But once I got that thought in my mind, that obsession, that compulsion, I would just give into it. And I would just use because my disease told me I wanted to use. But as I began to get some strength and some substance and begin working the steps and begin hearing people share in meetings that I didn't have to get high unless I wanted to, that was a revelation for me. Because what that did was that let me know when times came and I wanted to use, I said, well, they said that I don't have to get high even if I want to. And I choose to believe in what you guys said, even if I hadn't believed it myself. And along with that revelation came the revelation that this too shall pass. One of my biggest character defects was impulsivity. You know, just immediately jumping on something. The minute I would get a feeling, I'd cuss you out. The minute I felt like I wanted to get high, I would just pick up and use. But y'all were telling me some new information. Y'all were telling me that this too shall pass. So I remember the first time I had about 30 days clean. I remember that urge to use came upon me. But I said, let me see if that slogan that this too shall pass really works. And so I sat. And I'm here to report to you that just by sitting still, that in about 10 minutes, the obsession and the compulsion to use was lifted. And I was like, wow, this too shall pass. So if it can pass this time, just maybe it will pass in the future. So by me being able to grasp that concept of this too shall pass, I'm here to report to you that the obsession to use, the compulsion to use, was lifted almost immediately. And I thank God for that. Some other things that began being revealed to me early in my recovery was that it's okay to not be perfect. I always set big, high standards for myself because I used drugs for so long that once I finally made it in here, which my clean date is December 13th, 1996. I wanted everything overnight. I wanted the daughter restored. I wanted the job back. I wanted all of my social security cards and license, bam, just somebody to wave a wand and to be right there. I wanted everything right away. And I wanted everything to be done perfectly. I wanted everything to be in my life instantly the way it would have normally been had I not been using all of the time prior. But again, with the help of a sponsor and step work and coming into meetings, I learned that it's okay right where you are. Don't look at and don't beat up on yourself about where you're not. Look at all of the places where you are. You're clean today. You didn't pick up today. You're being guided by a sponsor today. You've got love and support that you never had before today. And it's not that important for you to do it all right. Just do it. And so I began learning that if I set goals and standards on my life, that I would be operating at a level here, but then I found myself practicing some behavior that put me here. I learned to say, that's all right, Judith. God is still real pleased and still real proud of you. Push that restart button on your life. You can do it better the next time. But I learned to not beat up on myself and set high, perfected standards for myself, but to learn how to accept myself right where I was. And one of the other things that began really getting revealed to me early in recovery was the spiritual ironies, the spiritual axioms, things that used to really blow me away, like the only way to keep it is to give it away. Or the more you give, the more you get. That totally made no sense, because when I was out there in active addiction, the more crack I gave you, the less I would have. So I really wasn't trying to give a lot of people a whole bunch of things. But as I transferred from that dark place into the light, the light of the spiritual program called Narcotics Anonymous, I noticed that natural things didn't make any spiritual sense. And that I had moved from a old place to a new place, and so I had to take on a new mindset, new ideas, new ways of operating in my life. So I learned that the only way to keep what I had was to give it away, and I learned that the more that I gave you, the more I would have. Wow, what a spiritual irony. I also learned, it also got revealed to me, that it was in my admitting my powerlessness in and of myself, now I had some power. It just blew me away. But I was like, wow, so much was being revealed to me once I made that conscious choice to stop using. And to not just stop using, but to recover. Because as most of us know, clean time does not equal recovery. So something else that was revealed to me was the fact that I had a revelation at about 4 months. Because I was doing everything y'all said. I was surrendering my ideas in my way, and I was being led and guided by a sponsor. And I realized at about 4 months clean that just maybe, if I put my ego at the door, that just maybe if I took the suggestions that my sponsor and my network gave me, regardless of whether or not I agreed, that just maybe I could stay clean. And so what that required of me was a spiritual principle called submission. It's not submission when the sponsor would ask me to do something and I agreed or that it made sense. But what submission was doing something that the sponsor said to me, even if it didn't make sense, even if I disagreed with her, even if I would bet money that my idea was the better way, but out of a simple faith and trust, doing that thing anyway, that was called submission, and that was a necessary tool in order for me to move forward in my program of recovery. So I made a decision at month 4 that just maybe, if I let go of my know-it-allism, I could stay clean. And I remember wanting recovery so bad that I was willing to let go of my know-it-allism. And I'm still clean today, almost 12 years later. Another spiritual revelation, because there's so many, but another spiritual revelation, something else that was revealed to me as I began this journey of growth and progress, was that I would want change so bad. I would want to let go of the toxic, unhealthy relationship so bad. And I would always be up in my head thinking about how I could get out of this. And then y'all told me that you can't think yourself into a new way of living. You got to live yourself into a new way of thinking. And the primary reason that I kept setting myself up for these toxic, unhealthy relationships was because I didn't love me. I would go into a relationship trying to buy the love, trying to give the man the whole loaf of my heart. But my self-esteem was so low, I was like, oh me? I'll just settle for crumbs. I'll just settle for the crumbs. But something happened along the way in recovery, and I began to realize that I was better than crumbs, and I deserved more than just being somebody's secret. And so it was told to me that I would have to begin the journey of self-love in order to be able to get out of and stay out of toxic relationships. So they told me I had to start doing loving things for self, even when I didn't feel like it. I had low self-esteem, so I didn't want to do loving things for myself. But they said you can't think yourself into a new way of living. You have to live yourself into a new way of thinking. So I began getting the nails done right as I was approaching 40. Now, you know when I was out there in active addiction, I wasn't spending $20 on no nails. That represented the cost of a rock. now I'm in recovery, and I moved over to the other side, and y'all told me I had to do loving things for myself. So I began getting the nails done. I began getting the pedicures. I began taking bubble baths and candles in silence. And then y'all told me something that really frightened me. You guys said that I should buy myself some roses. Now, y'all were taking it too far then. I was like, love me like that? Y'all were like, yeah, love you like that. And that was hard for me. And I justified that I couldn't afford the roses. Now, at the time, I was working for a law firm in D.C., and the roses only cost $3 a half a dozen. But that wasn't the point. The point was, do you feel worthy enough to buy yourself some roses? Do you feel worthy? And that was at a point in my life when I had let go of a toxic relationship that really hurt. And they said, you don't have to wait for a man to come and buy you roses. You can buy yourself some roses. And so I bought the roses. But I set them on my desk way back here. And all of the people on the job was coming by, and they were complimenting me on the roses. And they were like, ooh, you got roses. You got a man. Who bought you those roses? And I was able to say, no, they came from me, for me. And as the day began to progress, and as the people came by and complimented me on how beautiful the roses were, slowly but surely, I started moving the roses closer and closer and closer. And by the end of the day, those roses was right up under my nose. And I was loving them and loving me. And so I may buy myself roses twice a week, part of my self-love practice, part of the journey to self-love that I needed so desperately. Then they took it to another level with me. They said, you should write yourself some love letters for 40 days. What? But I wanted change more than I wanted to stay the same. And we learn here in recovery that when the pain of staying the same becomes greater than the pain of change, we'll change. Change you must or die you will. They said if I didn't change, that the same Judith would find herself in a crack house again. And I don't want to smoke no crack no more. So I became willing to do the things that they told me to do. So I began writing love letters to myself. I'm talking about writing a love letter to myself early in the morning at work, putting it in an envelope, putting a stamp on it to my home address, and then the next day, I would run to my mailbox like an eager little kid at Christmas to open up this love letter to me, from me. I'm here to report to y'all that it works. I use such loving, such affectionate, such endearing terms with myself. I call myself Precious and Judykins and Babykins. And it's going to be all right. Don't worry about that relationship. Just know that whatever leaves your life makes room for something better. It's going to be all right. And I love you. It works. It works. And what began to happen was that a love that I never knew that I could have for myself began burgeoning in my spirit. And why these practices of self-love was necessary was because the more love, the more self-love and more self-acceptance that I could summon for myself, the less likely I would find myself being in these toxic relationships that was less than what I deserved. And since this is an honest program, I want to ask y'all in the room, how many of you here have ever been in a relationship that was less than what you deserved? How many? I think the people, there's one guy got two hands raised, a couple of hands raised. And I think the couple of people that didn't raise their hand just might be in a little bit of denial. Being in toxic relationships was a big part of my story. But as I began to grow in recovery, I got to the place where I was able to say, I want a man who can really be a partner to me, or no one at all. Nothing in between will do anymore. And I'm willing to wait, because God had promised that he would rock with me through the loneliness. He would rock with me through the pain. So I went through my celibate period, as Cindy shared, And it wasn't hard, it was new. And I remember going through that period. And I remember the pain and the loneliness that came as a result of that. But I remember the God of my understanding saying that he was going to be there with me. And I remember that God also said, you've given your definition of a healthy mate, but are you a mate worth having? So God said, I need you to sit still and let me work on some other areas of your life. I need you to let me take out some more areas of your life so that when that divine mate does appear, I too would be a mate worth having. And would no longer be that needy, clinging, insecure, fear of other woman-centered individual that I had become. So God said, I need you to wait. And he rocked me through the loneliness. And he got me to a place where I was able to not look at where I thought the companionship should come from, because I thought it should be in a man, but I began to tap into the relationship that God had put before me. Another real painful period in my life that God caused a big revelation in was the relationship with my sisters. I, in my addiction, really needed my sisters who were in New Jersey, and I'm here in Maryland, but I needed them to be here for me. I needed them to uphold me. I needed them to tell me that it was going to be all right. We got your back. And they weren't there for me. They looked upon me with contempt. Oh, crackhead. And I needed them to be there for me. And it hurt that my sisters weren't there for me. And I cried out to God. I need my sisters. And even while I was in the midst of getting high, God revealed two things to me. He said, number one, I'm going to get you clean, and you're not going to die. He said, and number two, I'm going to restore that unit with your sisters. But even before I do that, I'm going to put women in your life who will more than make up for the nurturing and love that you don't get from your biological sisters. So it got revealed to me that blood is not necessarily thicker than water. So I began looking not at where I thought the love and support should come, but who God was sending my way. And God is faithful because he began putting men and women in my life. Not only who I could minister and be a help to, but those who could upgird me and who could nurture me along my path so that I could stay clean. He made every unit complete. He made it so that I wasn't a motherless child anymore or a fatherless child. I'm not a sisterless girl today. And since then, my unit with my family has been restored. As Cindy said, I too was the black sheep of the family. And for many years, I had to make a conscious decision of whether or not I was going to go to Jersey for the holidays, because I had a family who needed me to be the same so that they could be the same. And I wasn't the same person anymore. Wow. And so after my mom passed, I had to make a conscious decision. Am I going to go to the family house where my siblings are just to be tolerated? Do I make the 3-hour trip to Jersey and the 3-hour back to be tolerated when I can keep my precious self right here in Maryland and be celebrated? And so for many Thanksgivings and many Christmases, I've made the conscious choice to not go back. But in recent years, God has again been putting it in my spirit, you need to go. I need you to show them who I am, the glory and the manifestation of me in your life. I need you to go. And so when I went Thanksgiving, I had such a wonderful time. There was no denying that the black sheep wasn't black anymore. And I began seeing my family more on the appreciate. Not they ain't there with the celebrating yet. But they had moved from toleration to appreciation. And I could work with that. And so I enjoyed myself so much that I went Christmas. And I'll be going again. Matter of fact, I told them, because they acted like they didn't know I could cook. I told them I'm cooking a whole Thanksgiving dinner next year to put them to shame. And I'm doing that, of course, not just on a competition level, but out of love. When I cook, it's a way of showing love. And just to be able to have moved from not wanting to go to Thanksgiving to going and cooking the whole Thanksgiving dinner, what growth. And I owe that all to God and to this program. So more and more things are being revealed to me as I come forward. But now I want to tell you one of the greatest revelations that I've had since I've been here, and that was in recognizing who God is in my life. Let me explain to you what I mean. There have been so many years when I wasn't working, had awesome skills, went to high school all through college, and I had awesome skills. But when it came time to presenting and showing myself on the job front, one of the number one things that the employers want to know is what? How can you possibly explain all of these gaps in your resume? Gaps, big gaps. And I thought of everything in the book. I would like to say I sit up here and told you I was honest with him, but I wasn't. I didn't trust God enough to be honest, so I would fill in the missing blanks in my resume. And I would get hired off of the jobs that I so-called did. And it worked for me at the time, but what has gotten revealed to me since, had I been honest at that point, I may have been doing what I'm doing now quicker. But I thought I was so clever that I would make up stories about, you know, to justify the gap. And back then, they weren't, I don't know, they just weren't checking the way that they're doing now. But I remember, going the temp route, the temp to perm route. And I remember a temp agency telling me that I had maybe 6 weeks on a job. So I already had added and figured that money all up. So when I would get a call from the temp agency, I would go into this massive dose of fear, trepidation, heart would start beating. Because I just know it's this temp agency calling me, telling me that my assignment had ended prematurely. And I remember having a lot of fear. And I remember once I talked to that temp agency lady on the phone, and she told me the only reason she was calling was to make sure I had gotten my timesheet in the mail, or the only reason she was calling was to make sure that things were going well on the job, then all of a sudden I would feel relief. Well, the relationship that I had developed with God at that point, God was not happy with me getting relief upon hearing her words. God said, no, I want you to find relief upon hearing my words. I am your source. That job is only your resource. And once I was able to get in touch with the fact that God is my source and that job or a million other jobs are only my resource, I was able to walk in peace. Now, that didn't happen overnight. I mean, once he revealed that to me, it took a while. It took situations and circumstances. But be careful what you pray for. I've been praying to God for trust. You know, when I pray to God for patience, what happens? I get every red light, the longest line in the grocery store. So when I began praying to God to let me trust him, he allowed many fearful situations to come in my life. And it was through the fearful situations, it was through the pain that Cindy talked about, that I began to grow. And I got to a point where I began to trust God with my finances. I began to trust God with my life. I began to trust God with situations with my daughter, you know, because I got in touch with the fact that God is the source and these other things are only the resource. That was very powerful for me. That was one of the greatest revelations that I've had. And I always have to remind myself when certain situations happen that God is my source and the job or people, place, and thing is only the resource. I remember in relationships when I really wanted to be there with this man because he was really the one for me. And then the weirdest thing happened and all of a sudden I was out of that relationship and I couldn't understand it. And I would feel rejected. What got revealed to me that what I saw as rejection was really God's protection. God has a hedge of protection around me. He's not going to just let any old thing in. So what I saw as rejection was really God's protection, moving me in another direction. There's a lot of situations going on in my life right now. And what I'm learning, the revelation for me is that whatever looks bad on the outside, it's an opportunity for growth. Whatever, when something gets old, it's time to do something new. Recovery has taught me to do something new. It got revealed to me that another revelation was that this piece about fear. When I first came into recovery, I feared failure. But as I began to grow in recovery and knew I had some things going on, knew I had some valuable things to share, that fear transferred from being fear of a failure to fear of successful, because failure was where I had hid out most of my life. And even a semblance of light, it frightened me. And so I would feel fear. And in my fear, I would be stuck on stupid. And then y'all introduced me to the spiritual concept of courage and the definition of courage. And there was a profound definition of courage that I really like. And it's courage is fear that has said her prayers. Or courage is fear that has said his prayers. So courage is not the absence of fear. Courage is that even in the midst of fear, you do that thing anyway. So I'm learning to do things afraid. Prior to getting the revelation and the definition of courage, I thought that to feel fear meant I had to stop. But what it means is that even when I feel fear, I can go forward and I can get that thing accomplished. Because the only way to go through is to go through. You can't go around it. You got to go through to get to the other side. And so I learned to master my fear. I learned to say, fear, I know you're going to come, but come on, because I got something greater than you. We have a saying in recovery, and it says that we can do one of two things with fear. We can either say F everything and run, or we can face everything and recover. In most instances today, I'm choosing to face everything, and as a result, I'm recovering. So the whole fear piece, the knowing that God, even in my feeling fear, the God of my understanding says, don't have fear. And I'm like, that doesn't make sense. What can you explain that? And what God revealed to me is even if there's a situation that comes up, even if I feel the fear, even if my heart beats or I start sweating, that's the feeling of fear. But I don't have fear because I don't have fear because I let my faith outweigh my fear. I let God's track record in my life prove to me that I can and I will make it to that other side as long as I don't use. And so even when I feel fear, I don't have fear because I know that as long as I'm not using, as long as I'm connected to God and the program of Narcotics Anonymous, that all is spiritually and fundamentally well, regardless of the surface appearance of things, regardless of how it looks on the outside. And so I move forward, and more is being revealed to me every day. As I said, I was caught up in the grip of addiction and couldn't get out. But I thank God that even when I was out there, even when I was estranged and active addiction and couldn't make it back in these rooms, I thank God that somebody prayed for me. At the end of each meeting, although I wasn't there, they prayed for the addict still suffering, that one day I would sit in that empty chair. And because of prayers, because of a readiness, and because of a God bigger than life, I was able to make it back in these rooms to do what? To turn around and be there for another suffering addict. I want to close with the fact that the greatest revelation of all is that the reason I stand before you today, the reason I didn't die, it's not even for me. And it ain't even about me. It's about being a vessel of service to God in this fellowship. Yes, I'm clean. Yes, I don't smoke crack anymore. Yes, I have moved from homelessness to home ownership. Yes, I have moved from rags to riches. And when I'm talking about that, I'm not necessarily talking about in the materialistic sense. I'm talking about you're looking at a girl who used to be beaten and bruised and battered and torn. But today I'm filled with love, with light, with joy, and the love of God. I feel good about myself today. But it's not about me. It's about taking this transformed life and pouring it into another's life. That's why the steps are necessary. That's why I have to do that step 6 and 7 and let the program and God take out that junk. The pride's got to go so that humility can come in. The fear has to go so that courage can come in. The selfishness has to go so that some selflessness can come in. The not caring or not giving an F about nobody else has to go so that the empathy and the compassion can come in. God needs to remake us from the inside out, so now that we're of some use, we can be a viable service to somebody else. The greatest revelation is the reason that I'm here today is to be of service to God and to this program. It's not even about me. Don't get it twisted, family. God wants to use us. It's all in the literature. It's all in the literature, especially in the 12th step, being of maximum service. So if I'm not willing to grow, and if I'm not willing to change, and if I'm not willing to address my character defects as they appear over and over again, I may be of some use. But the book is calling us to a higher order. It's saying that we are to strive to be of maximum service. And that's the revelation that I live and stand by. I thank God for a purpose-driven life. I thank God that even in situations